I've just checked the download numbers, and last month, 127,000 people downloaded this podcast. I can hardly believe it. I'm so incredibly grateful. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for sharing this content. You're absolutely amazing. But I'm a bit confused because only 228 people have signed up for our highlights email. And I know you're really, really busy, but this is the one email that's going to get to the point, give you the references, and enable you to improve your health, performance, and longevity. Let me give you an example of something that appeared in one of the emails in the Different Perspectives section. In a new popular book, a journalist describes knowing that he was losing fat because he could see it in his stools. Though obviously we weren't there, we're pretty sure that's not a good thing. During normal fat loss, you oxidize the fat, breathing it out as water and carbon dioxide. Fat in the stool is called steatorrhea and is often caused by malabsorption, gallstones, or damage to the liver or pancreas. Definitely not something to write home about. So, get to the point, give me the references, two of them right here. Head over to nourishbalancethrive.com/highlights. Now, over to the interview. Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name's Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Dr. Deborah Gordon. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Chris.
Thank you so much for joining me today. For people who do not know Deborah, she is a family medicine doctor in Ashland, Oregon, and she received her medical degree from the University of California at San Francisco, and she did a family practice residency and has since been in primary care practice for more than 30 years. That's pretty amazing. You must have seen and know a lot of stuff by now.
It's amazing to look back and say, how on earth has it possibly been 30 years? But it is.
I think that's a sign that you're having a lot of fun.
I am having fun, and I'd say increasingly more so the longer I practice.
And that's amazing. Well, I wanted to start by asking you why you do what you do. And I realize that's a very open-ended question. So let me be more specific. Back before I knew anything about health and fitness, and I'm not saying I know that much now, but I know a little bit more than I did at least 6 years ago, I went to see lots of family medicine doctors. And one of the reasons I started my business later on was I got the impression that they really didn't have the answers and they really didn't know what they were doing when they looked at my test results. And clearly you are so much different from that. And I know you're looking at things through this really powerful ancestral health lens. And I know that because you're a member of the Physicians for Ancestral Health. So tell me why it is that you do that. Why?
Well, I'd say it's been a circuitous route to get to where I am now. And it doesn't have one of those I was really sick and healed myself stories that a lot of people have. I've always been pretty healthy and I've always been interested in health. And I never grew up thinking I was going to be a doctor. I was a hippie living in a teepee in Northern California.
That's
and
awesome.
Thought, you know, hey, you know what? Maybe I should go to medical school. And, you know, I did pre-med. After the fact, my degree is in English literature, and went to medical school really intending always to do lifestyle medicine, to do preventive medicine. I unfortunately didn't develop any resources when I was in medical school for doing lifestyle medicine, but I did carry that with me, and I would say have been on a perpetual search that only began yielding results about the last 15 years. So the first 15 or 20 years of my practice, I did my best to avoid giving people prescriptions. And in fact, my first job here in Southern Oregon was as the medical director of a migrant farm worker clinic. And one day the executive director called me into her office and she said, you know, I'm concerned you're not writing enough prescriptions. And I said, well, I'm concerned then too, because I haven't done an adequate job educating my patients that they should be happy I'm not writing the prescriptions. But at that point, I had few resources to do things besides suggest to them that they eat healthy. And, you know, my idea of healthy then was not a way I ate, but I've always eaten really pretty well and never did avoid eggs and butter. But, you know, I adopted that whole, gee, maybe Dean Ornish is right mentality for a long time. And then about 10 or 15 years ago, I gradually learned about the Weston Price Foundation, Gary Taubes, and ancestral medicine. And that's when I feel like things have really taken off, really just giving me tools to understand what's going on with my patients and to give them more helpful advice than I could before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got lots of questions that are coming into my mind as you say that. But the first one I want to ask is, why not a naturopathic doctor or some other type of doctor? And like, given what you've just said, I'm quite surprised you ended up as a medical doctor. So why did that happen?
Okay, but remember, I went to medical school now 42 years ago.
Okay.
I went You know, so like, I didn't even know naturopaths existed back then.
Right. Okay.
So I'm sure if somebody asked me now, I'd say, unless you want to be an ER doc, you should be a naturopath, because they're clearly, their level of training has become more sophisticated over the last 10 or 15 years. And they definitely have the right approach that most medical doctors lack.
Right. And then how did you know that prescribing drugs was, in general, a bad idea?
That is a really, you know, I mean, I could say that, oh, my father was a Christian Scientist and they don't use drugs, but he wasn't really a practicing Christian Scientist. I just always thought that. So when I was a little kid, I remember playing in my cousin's library and opening a book and finding about the word pantheism, which is like God is in everything. And I am no spiritualist. I mean, that really sort of means nothing to me, but it gave me the concept that our bodies were a lot smarter than our brains are, that the things we create out of mental constructs are interesting and are great to play with, like literature, but our bodies are smarter. And I just kind of grew up with that. I'm not really sure where it came from.
Wow, that's amazing. I just find it so surprising that when you're young and impressionable and you go to a higher institute of education and everybody that you interact with just seems so experienced and so wise and so amazing. Now, your automatic reaction is just to believe everything they say and to retain that degree of independence in your thought, I think is quite extraordinary. So I'm not sure I fully understand how you've managed to acquire that, but it's quite amazing.
Right. I did sort of have this experience of, as I was, I'd always thought I was going to like go into obstetrics or something. And then I went to, did a family practice rotation, and it was really fun to not know who the next patient you were going to get was and to be constantly challenged. So I remember thinking, oh, this could actually be exciting, not just following a professional protocol. That was the difference with family practice, that you had to sort of shoot a little bit more from the hip, because you could be an orthopedics clinic and someone could say, could you look at this rash on my hip? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of it. And then I remember really clearly in my third year of my residency, kind of feeling like I woke up and came back to myself, you know, oh, I think I'll go backpacking again. Oh, I could go camping. I don't have to spend the next 4 weeks in some medical office. And felt like, you know, maybe in the middle of that process, Chris, I was more going along with the attitude of the people that were training me, because I thought they were smart and they were really great. But then I came back to, oh, wait a second, I'm going to take the least amount of medication possible and do my best for myself to avoid it. And gee, I ought to try and do that for my patients too.
And if I was to strip you of all of your credentials, what credentials would you go and get now?
I would probably seek out something like being a functional medicine health coach.
Okay.
Although I really do like some of this strictly medical stuff I've done. I love delivering babies. I love doing surgery. I liked it when I had patients in the ER or the ICU. And now I like having that authoritative voice. So I say, well, when I'm looking at your lipid panel, this is what I know
right.
as a doctor is the most important part.
Oh, it's definitely still a credential that demands a great deal of respect. But I'm really interested in what you said there about delivering babies. Do you believe that delivering babies should be a medicalized experience?
No.
Sorry, I'm like on the, just bouncing from foot to foot here with my questions. You can see I've got nothing planned, but I really would love to know the answer to this.
Right. No, it's really funny. I was married at the time and I was delivering babies kind of early in my practice. And my husband at the time said, this can't be right. You spend so much time with your patients. And he actually called a friend of ours who was a labor and delivery nurse and said, is Deborah doing something wrong? Because she's gone for hours when she's got a patient in labor. And she said, no, Deborah's doing it completely much more like a midwife than a doctor. And I prided myself on that as much as I could, like trying to figure out, like the only medical part is being the backup if something goes wrong and knowing how to understand whether you should do some testing along the way. But no, I was trying to get my patients to walk in labor and, you know, move around. And I, when I was having my daughter, I tried my best to have a home birth with a midwife, but I'm a doctor, so I ended up with a C-section, you know.
That's really interesting. We have the doctor I started Nourish Balance Thrive with. She's also a medical doctor. She had a home birth, and I thought that was quite wonderful that even with everything that she knows and all the dangers that she really understands, that she still wanted to do that. But I feel, right. You know, having been through the process personally with my wife, I feel like it's something that benefits tremendously from hindsight, right? Like with hindsight, we think, oh, we were idiots to go to the hospital. We should have just stayed at home. And then, of course, if something had gone wrong, you never would have forgiven yourself for not being in the hospital.
But a lot less goes wrong at home.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's like, it's a catch 22. It's difficult.
Yeah. My daughter, I figure she showed her true colors because, you know, so babies you have to bend your neck. You have to submit to the labor process as a baby to be born. And my daughter didn't. She had her head up and she was looking to see if she could find the way out. And you just can't be delivered that way. So, oh, no. You know, if I had a C-section, she and I both would have died. But we had plenty of warning. You know, I lived an hour from the hospital and it was not a difficult transport. So
interesting. And do you get a hard time from anyone in authority? Do you have a board or anyone else that gives you grief for doing diet and lifestyle medicine rather than just writing prescriptions?
You know, I think I, in my local community, no. I feel very comfortable in it. I'm lucky that I came here as a doctor who did the job none of the other doctors here wanted. So I was the doctor running the brand new migrant farm worker clinic. I had patients in all three hospitals. I had patients in intensive care. And so I have my street cred kind of in my medical community. And that said, there are still doctors who think I'm a quack. And actually, it's more for the fact that I used to do homeopathy and I still do, than that I do lifestyle medicine. And then my hormone prescribing, I know, is a red flag that the medical board could use if they wanted to. So I feel happy every year I go by without attracting their attention.
I've got to ask you about homeopathy now that you've mentioned it. I don't think so. You know, I know better than to think that I understand why something doesn't work, right? At this point, I've been wrong so many times. I dare not doubt something that I don't understand. But at the same time, I really don't understand homeopathy, not even a little bit. So can you give me any insight here?
Well, I have to say, you know, I only became really exposed to it because I broadcasted my utter cynicism and skepticism about it to some people whom I really respected, who did good work in other things. And they said, well, why don't you give it a shot? And even after I'd been a patient, when I entered the homeopathic training program, and it was mostly MDs, I was the cynic in the room. This can't possibly work. And I don't think anybody can really say how it works, except to, you know, the closest I can come is that the way we pick a remedy, a homeopathic remedy for somebody, is complex, but ultimately we're looking for the secondary effect of a medication. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you're really tired and you have a cup of caffeine, it will wake you up. But after the caffeine wears off, you'll probably be more tired than you were before you had the cup of coffee.
Right.
And so we're looking for a homeopathic medicine that, so for instance, if you had trouble sleeping, I'd give you the homeopathic remedy made from coffee. The coffee itself would wake you up, but then when you distill it down to the remedy, it has its secondary effect. Now, why it does that? I have no idea, but I've seen it work. So I've also seen it fail brilliantly. You know, I'm the best at picking the wrong homeopathic remedy that doesn't work at all. But my daughter broke her arm and she was screaming in pain and not able to have her x-ray taken. And we put some arnica on her mouth and she was 7 years old. It's not like, I don't think placebo could have worked at that point. And she completely stopped crying and cooperated with the x-ray. And actually, my first case, Chris, was my dog. So I had we were backpacking in the Tetons and we woke up the next morning and my dog would not move. In fact, I thought she might have been dead. We put water in her mouth and food in her mouth and she didn't respond or didn't move at all. And again, I put like a homeopathic remedy, which I was just traveling with as a lark because I really didn't believe this stuff, in her mouth. And she like shook her head, shook her body, woke up, and she was completely ready to go for the rest of the day. And so that's sort of like, you know, in medicine, we're supposed to do things by the scientific method. And then at the same time, you can read the articles by the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine that says research will completely point you down the leftward path now. And in 10 years, it's going to turn you completely around and send you down on the rightward path. So I also go by principle So I read evidence, but I also go by principle, which could be physiology or it could be evolution. And then I also go by experience. So if I put a homeopathic remedy on my dog's mouth and she is completely better, that counts, even though I have no idea how it would work.
Mm-hmm. Do you not think it could just be the placebo effect, even with a dog?
Yes, I think certainly. But then if you're going to say that the placebo effect works with animals, then you have to acknowledge that there's some level of communication between you and the animal, or you and the infant, because I've used it with infants too, that's more powerful and irrational than anything I'd understand if it worked for you. So if placebo worked for you, you could easily say, oh, you're an adult, you kind of wanted to have a bizarre experience with homeopathy. But how do you explain it that the three-year-old with mumps, by the time you put the third remedy in their lap, stops crying and gets down on the floor to play with the toys? You know, it's like...
I appreciate that. And you know, so this is something I really learned from my wife, who'd been around many small children, her brothers, before we had our baby. And right from the beginning, she would talk to Ivy, even when she was an infant and had really no way of responding. And then by the time now she's 3 years old, she's like a little comedian. She has an incredible vocabulary. She's extremely verbal compared to other children I've seen. Her comedic timing is phenomenal. She's a really funny little girl. And I'm sure, I mean, maybe it would have been the same, but I'm sure it was because Julie knew to talk to her even when she was an infant. So what that tells me is there must be, like, they're listening, right? There is a connection, even though they can't really talk back.
Absolutely. And I think, and I think there are plenty of studies showing that younger siblings don't talk because they expect their older siblings to talk for them, and that only kids that don't have siblings end up with an adult patter way before kids who are raised by their older, less verbal siblings.
Right. And do you ever say to your patients, so the only thing that worries me about this, I'm all for harnessing the power of the placebo, if that's what it is. And I don't really know that that's what it is. But let's say it is. I'm all for that. But do you ever worry the homeopathic medicine is going to displace real medicine at an appropriate time? So I'm thinking about homeopathic, the emergency room, right? I should link to this very funny video that people should watch in the show notes. But do you ever worry about that sort of thing?
All my friends said that to me. Well, I think you have to be smart about it. But there's a lot, and sometimes don't you think you've done someone, for instance, one of the great service, even if homeopathy turns out to be like totally disproven and I get to the point where I think, oh my gosh, that's really ridiculous. I can't believe I did it. I just think I only wrote about 3 antibiotic prescriptions in 10 years of a heavy pediatric practice.
Wow.
So even if all I did was give them something to hold their hands while they survive their virus and, calm down their fear, then I did a benefit by replacing them conventional medicine. So, yeah, you have to be smart. You know, if I thought somebody had appendicitis, I would, the famous saying is I'd give them the remedy as I put them in the ambulance.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm all for it. And who knows, we've made enough U-turns at this point. Tommy just posted this infographic that was sent to him by Mark Cucuzella, and it was instructions for athletes should do to fuel their activity. And it is the exact opposite of what anybody should be doing. It's absolutely phenomenal. So I should link to that in the show notes too.
Oh, I'd like to see it. I'm on the rowing team at, we have a rowing club locally, and I'm on the women's racing team. And the coach's wife is a dietitian, which makes me immediately suspect. I know they're great dietitians, but she had an evening class for eating for performance, and I couldn't go, but I wish I could have been a fly on the wall, because I'm afraid she probably followed that infographic.
The spoiler is carbs, carbs, and more carbs, right? Carbs before, carbs during, carbs after. That's how it went.
Right, yeah. I think that, I look around at the group of us. So in our rowing club, our ages span from middle schoolers to I think our oldest rower is 87 or 88 years old. And, the advice you might give a teenager still has a risk of generating a diabetic athlete, somebody like Tim Noakes, who was never heavy.
Right.
But I look around my peers on the women's racing team, many of whom you can diagnose metabolic syndrome walking by them. And right. I think, I hope they didn't go to that talk.
Yeah. Well, I really wanted to talk to you today about autoimmunity in postmenopausal women. So maybe I should start by asking you, is this something that you see frequently in your practice?
It is something I see frequently, often that I'll either diagnose it or people are walking around with 1, 2, or 3 diagnoses themselves.
And tell me about the types of autoimmunity that you see.
Autoimmune disease is so funny because, you know, I think if you've got an ancestral perspective, you look at what's in common with all these autoimmune diseases. But of course, people and most physicians separate them out and put them in completely little different tidy packages. So I'd say I see probably, well, obviously the most common is Hashimoto's because that's kind of the most common, I think, in general. But I also see celiac and Sjogren's and different kinds of colitis. I think some of the inflammatory autoimmune colitises that we know a lot about, like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, often hit people when they're younger. But there are diseases that are autoimmune and pertain to the colon that hit women more when they're older. So, I mean, you know, in general, that if you have four autoimmune patients, three of them are likely to be women. It's much more common in women. So I have two or three women who've developed in their 50s or 60s a microscopic or collagenous colitis, which is still autoimmune, just not as well known as Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. So it's scattered all around. Sjogren's is common, though, pretty common. And you know what that is? That's where the most common presentation of Sjogren's is to have devastatingly, irritatingly dry eyes that bothers people most at night, but can bother them during the day too. But it can also be a presentation of a dry mouth. So that's when I think I've got like half a dozen patients with some form of Sjogren's, symptomatic or not.
So and do you think, sorry, go on.
I was going to say it's all over the body, you know, different ones.
And what do you think is driving the diagnosis? Is it just limited? So sometimes I wonder whether many autoimmune diagnoses are happening because we just happen to frequently screen for the antibodies for that particular disease, right? So Hashimoto's is a really good example where it's on every thyroid panel, and so you're more likely to see it. And maybe some types of autoimmunity, we've not even developed the assay yet, so you wouldn't see it as much. And do you think that's a fair comment, or do you think...
I think that is a fair comment, but I think you're talking to some pretty unusual doctors if you think the Hashimoto's antibodies are on most panels.
That's true. It's true. I most likely am.
Okay, you've had thyroid disease for 30 years. Has anyone ever tested you for Hashimoto's? No, I've never heard of it.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, 50% of those people probably end up that they do have some form. I'm always surprised. I found myself to be low thyroid a number of years ago, which really presented as cardiovascular problems, which, of course, they wanted to treat cardiovascularly, but all I had to do was take a little thyroid and they all went away. And I was sure, of course, that I had Hashimoto's. Come on, keep testing me. No, you don't have Hashimoto's. So, you know, I think I go out on a limb looking for autoimmune disease in places where there's reason to suspect it, but people haven't looked for it. So, for instance, one of the epidemics with metabolic syndrome and diabetes and everything else that we're seeing is atrial fibrillation. There's kind of two heart-related epidemics that are a little weird. One's congestive heart failure, but that's really because of statin use. But the other one is atrial fibrillation. And, you know, that you probably see it at it affects athletes, not
right. It's tremendously common. Yes.
So I like to get the Cyrex Laboratories, which has the more specialized testing. You have to have a patient who's willing to pay for it. They have some, I think, they have a couple heart antibodies on there, but it's pretty easy to get anti-cardiolipin antibodies. That's a conventional lab will do that. And I'd say one out of every four of the patients with persistent arrhythmias that I test has antibodies, which is associated with an increased risk of not just atrial fibrillation, but other cardiovascular disease like stroke and heart attack. So those are people where I can say, okay, you don't just have atrial fibrillation, you have to get more sleep. If we think of this as an autoimmune disease, what are the implications in that for not only understanding why you have it, but for treating it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. I've never heard this before. So tell me, what is the treatment?
Well, they treat autoimmune disease affecting the heart the same way you treat autoimmune disease affecting the gut. So there's a triad that I think, I'm not sure who put this together, but you have a genetic susceptibility and you have leaky gut and then you have a stressor, and that can be an acute or chronic stressor. And those are the settings in which someone develops autoimmune disease. So you piece those apart. Okay, you can't do anything about your genetics. So you know that you're someone, if you've got an autoimmune disease, who's not only prone to continue having it, but prone to get another one. So once you have one, you're more likely to get another one. But leaky gut, you know what to do for that. And a stressor, you know what to do for that. So
right. No, well, don't pretend that everyone else knows. So what would you do for a leaky gut? How do you diagnose it in the first place? That's something that I've almost wondered about for a long time. Like, I don't think there's any really great tests on the market that would reveal that you have a leaky gut, or maybe you would disagree.
No, I would agree with you. And I would just say, so I'm convinced enough of that triad's existence, and I really kind of more use it as a tool of argument. So I say that, wow, Chris, I think, you know, your atrial fibrillation and these antibodies, you probably have a leaky gut, and we can do some expensive testing, or we can do what we would do to remedy that. And so I talk to people about Fasano's paradigm of the tight junctions. I like to act things out. I'm kind of a ham and very dramatic. And so, you know, I'll build a little intestinal lining model with my fingers wedged really closely together. And I say, for all of us, when we eat gluten, those tight junctions spread. And so molecules of food are absorbed way earlier in the colon, in the intestine, than they should be. And of course, that's going to provoke an allergic response of some sort, an autoimmune response. And if you're healthy and gluten causes the junction between your intestinal cells to open, but you're healthy, it evidently must close up again, or you must not react to the proteins, or I don't know what happens. Because, you know, you get leaky gut, you get increased intestinal permeability if you eat gluten. But I mean, I've heard enough about your gut that I know you don't eat it, but you know you get intestinal permeability when you go out for a hard ride.
Right, of course. Yeah, there's many factors.
And so, you know, I would say to somebody who's an athlete, not only should they not eat gluten, but they should be careful what they eat after they exercise.
Uh-huh. And do you ever get women, so say I'm a postmenopausal woman, I've just walked into your office and you've diagnosed me with an autoimmune disease. Do you ever see those women that are still eating gluten?
I'd say 3/4 of the people that walk into my office have not fixed their diet on their own. So, you know, I have much more of a medical paradigm than a health coach paradigm. So some people come to me having read my website and understood that I'm going to take them off gluten. One woman came in. It was funny because not only did she go to high school with me and I didn't even recognize her until she told me at the end of our appointment, but she'd read my website and she knew I was going to take her off gluten, but she had to wait and come in to see me to decide to do it. So I'd say most people, I'm encouraging them to make some dietary changes, you know, to do a real paleo. So I usually do it in 2 stages. I'll encourage people to, I assume gluten's a problem and some people need to be shown that. And so I will do a test at the hospital for gluten sensitivity. And I say, if you fail that test, you are absolutely gluten sensitive and forget it. You just need to be off gluten for the rest of your life. But most people pass that test. And if they really need to be convinced, I'll run them through Cyrex, because, you know, that's much more sensitive test for many more antibodies.
Mm-hmm. And they usually fail that test.
Right. I'm always amazed when people pass that test. Wow, you don't have any gluten sensitivity. That's pretty rare. But, you know, there's definitely some people or it's really minimal. And then even with that information, I'd still say I'm only about 75% effective in making my case and getting people to change their lifestyle. And younger, the better. Well, that's not really true. I don't know what it is. Some people, food, I'm sure you've seen this too. The hardest thing in the world is to get people to change what they eat for some people. Other people, great. Do whatever you say.
Yeah, no, I was definitely one of those people where I just didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then I met my wife and she said, yeah, you should definitely stop eating these 2 really common food allergens before you go any further. I'm like, oh, really? And, you know, once I had the information, it was trivial for me to execute it. I have no emotional attachment to food whatsoever. And that's not to say I don't get addicted to things that are addictive, like caffeine, for example, or theobromine. But yeah, once I know the answer, I'm pretty good at executing that. And I wondered whether you would be better because you can don a white lab coat and put a stethoscope around your neck and say, doctor's orders, no gluten, and then people would take notice of you. But you're telling me that's not true.
Well, it's also, I'm not really, you know, I wield something because of my MD, but I'm not really a very bossy sort of person. But maybe people who know me might disagree. I think I have more effectiveness than I imagine. But, you know, I've got some very good friends. Well, I think isn't it often the case that it's your closest friends or worse, your family members who don't listen to your advice?
Oh, yeah, of course. Why would they? Yeah, no, I don't. Even Tommy doesn't try and work with his family members. We stayed with him in Iceland and his mum was asking him all sorts of questions. And he was the most evasive I've ever seen him be about health questions. He's normally so willing to please, so willing to respond to all of those questions in the greatest of detail. And for his dear old mum, he was like trying to refer her to somebody else, you know.
Yeah, one of my friends who's a doctor in town sent me her sister, and she said, you know, you'll be the one who'll be able to get her to eat better for her than I can do.
That's super interesting. Yeah. Well, tell me about, you mentioned an acute stressor as part of that triad. What do you think that is?
You mean, why does that contribute to autoimmune disease?
Yeah, so I'm just wondering what you meant by an acute stressor. So when you say that, I'm thinking of maybe some type of acute or maybe chronic infection, or maybe it was a stressful situation like a death in the family, or maybe you just hate
exactly.
your job.
And so I have a patient who was, we had a local, very successful political campaign here a couple years ago, and our county and the adjacent county outlawed the growth of genetically modified crops. And a patient of mine was very active, and she was burning the candle at both ends and not sleeping enough and really just not taking care of herself. And she developed atrial fibrillation in that setting. And so that was her stressor that triggered it off. Looking at her, I would imagine she's the perfect paradigm of something that you mentioned earlier, which is I had never diagnosed her with an autoimmune disease before,
right.
but I wouldn't be surprised that she had one.
Right, right.
Because she'd always been just, you know, you see, so one of the things I see in my practice that I would assume is something along the lines of what you're talking about is women who, or men, but I'd say I just see more women who are carrying something that looks like a mild chronic degree of inflammation. So there, if we do the HSCRP test, which, you know, is called by the conventional world normal below 3, but I really like it below 1, they might have a slightly elevated HSCRP of around 2 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they carry a little bit of extra weight around their middle, and they don't really, they may sleep pretty well, but not great enough. And maybe they don't exercise in a really helpful way, but their bodies are just slowly becoming more and more unhealthy, you know, gaining weight, getting weaker, more muscle turning to fat. And what is that level of inflammation that's lurking in their body? And it's great. This man came in to see me about 5 years ago, and he was a little bit overweight. He had high blood pressure, sinus problems, but he took the sort of paleo low carb message, and he and his wife just ran with it. And you could just see over the next 6 months, something that you see in your coaching, but he really came to me for actually, I think, homeopathic treatment for his sinus infection, but he heard the nutritional piece of it and he got off. I think he's on a still a little bit of antihypertensive, but he one by one got off everything and got what he would say is got his body back.
Awesome. That's amazing. And what would you do for the person that's in this stressful situation? I'm really interested to know, because my experience has been that obviously stressful situations exist, but for people that don't have any stress, they tend to invent something to get stressed out over anyway. So what do you do for people like that?
So, you know, I wonder about, I mean, I would say the same thing, that just don't get so stressed about, you know, what do you, but I actually think they just have a level of literal pathology that is harder for us to understand. And it would be something on the level of anxiety, you know, in the realm of mental illness, that you really think that they're creating a rocky path for themselves where it needn't be, but that really is their experience. And so this can be it's really trial and error from my point of view, that it's giving them some tools to relax. So it might be, you know, I went to the Dale Bredesen training, the session I think before you did last year. And one of the tools that Dr. Bredesen referred to is the Brainwave app.
Right.
He says, you know, that's meditation on steroids. And I thought, great, finally a meditation I can do. I can do it in 5 or 10 minutes. And somebody else is really doing it. I plug into the app and it really, yeah, I do it when I'm pretty sure I'm not going to sleep well that night. I do it, and sometimes I do it other times. And so I might say someone to try that. I have another patient who I suggested she do heart math for heart rate variability or exercise. You know, it's trial and error trying a massage, improve their vitamin D, get it not just from supplements, but from the sun. And then, you know, I'm looking myself because I really do believe people want to be healthy. So when I have somebody who I think is putting obstacles in their own way, you know, I'll look under all sorts of rocks to see what could be fueling what seems to be self-destructive behavior. Like, you know, I'll do a Genova Diagnostics nutritional evaluation panel to see if there's some small nutrients or nutrients out of balance that might help with them. And, you know, a few times that's what really helps, or finding, you know, one little thing that's out of balance. And sometimes we can tweak it right.
And what do you normally see on these Genova panels? I'm quite interested in that.
There's a couple things that you can predictably see. So I think most people are low in vitamin A, which I think has way more to do with general immunity, but could conceivably have to do with autoimmunity. And it has to do with, you know, people don't eat liver. Do you eat liver?
I do, every morning. Yeah, we're a big fan of the US wellness meats, which is sort of cheating, really, because all you have to do is order it and it turns up and it tastes just like deli meat. You know, even my 3-year-old daughter loves that stuff. So that makes it super easy.
Right. So you're like eating the liverwurst or something like that.
Yeah, liverwurst and Braunschweiger is really good. We really like the head cheese as well. But my wife will prepare, you know, when we can get them. We're finding it increasingly difficult to get, not increasingly, but difficult to get organ meats from the local butcher that's embedded within our supermarket. But they do have some stuff sometimes. And she'll prepare liver. Liver pate is another really easy one that anybody can like.
It is. And so I was at my daughter's this weekend. She lives in Missoula. And a friend of hers, who's kind of my, you know, second daughter, had been sick a lot recently. And she came over and we actually made chicken liver for dinner. There's a recipe on my website for chicken liver mousse that I borrowed with permission from Ben Greenfield. And it's this fantastic recipe for eggs, chicken liver, onion, apples, and spices. And it's really good. And so this woman came over who'd been sick recently. She said, I'll just start with a really little piece of it, you know, and she ended up eating several pieces of liver and taking some home. And I think it'll help her get over her cold. But I think it's very often, and there's two parts to it. People don't eat liver. And then, you know, there's a genetic SNP. And Denise, I learned about this from Denise Minger, the BCMO1 gene, which has to do with how successfully you can convert beta carotene to vitamin A.
Ah.
And if you have that SNP, if you have any fatty liver, if you drink alcohol, and if you're over 50, you can't very well convert beta carotene to vitamin A. So I see a lot of vitamin A deficiency in the people who do avoid grains or bread. The way I tell them, everybody's deficient in B1 and B2, according to Genova. And I think it's because we don't eat fortified bread.
Oh, wow. That's quite depressing. So what would you have people do instead?
So again, a lot of my practice is, you know, people over the age of 50, where they have a scattering of things and of things that might be deficient or flags for a deficiency. And I feel very happy if I can get them to get this concept of nutrient density. So I worry a lot about really whether they're getting a wide variety of foods and getting enough nutrients. So I'm a multivitamin proponent. I have a multivitamin that is specifically for older folks. You know, it's without copper and iron, which I think tend to accumulate to our disadvantage in a lot of older people. And yeah, so I throw have them take a few multivitamins a day. Or it's, you know, it's one of those thorn ones where you're supposed to take like 6 a day. And I generally have people take 4 and try to cover the bases that way. And, you know, for some people, wow, I feel so much better since I'm doing what you told me to do from the Genova panel. And other people say, well, I can't really see any difference. And then I figured that wasn't the stone that needed to be turned over.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely still take a multivitamin every day. I've just got back from 3 weeks away in Colorado, and that was the one supplement I took with me was the Thorn EXOS multivitamin, because I just really don't want to go there, right? Like the problems associated with nutritional deficiencies are devastating, whereas the problems associated with excess, with the possible exception of maybe chronic iron overload, or as you mentioned, copper, there's really not that many problems, right? I'd much rather be in the nutritionally replete camp.
Yeah, and I think, you know, multivitamins get a bad rap because most people buy bad multivitamins.
Right, right.
Or the one that's wrong for them. So, you know, a non-menstruating woman or a man, I mean, they need to be careful of iron and copper. And
So how would you know that someone's has too much copper? Is there some testing that you do?
I routinely do one of the tests that Dr. Bredesen talked to us about and you learned about from him, which is to compare your levels of serum copper and serum zinc. So a little bit, you know how like you need to balance your omega-3s and omega-6s, because part of what omega-3s do is clean up some of the problem that omega-6s cause, particularly in the brain.
Right.
Well, it's the same thing with copper and zinc, in that copper is really essential and you need it in the brain. But if you have too much of it, it can cause problems, and you should balance it by having an even higher level of zinc in your blood. So that's good for brain health and good for immunity. So I have been routinely testing copper and zinc levels in people for a long time. And it's funny because my friend, Dr. Anne Hathaway, whom you know,
of course,
we were comparing our practices, and she says, oh no, all my patients are higher in zinc than in copper. And I said, wow, all my patients are higher in copper, and I've got to figure out a way to build up their zinc. So, I don't know if it's living at this altitude or our local water or what, but I definitely see a lot of people, relatively speaking, deficient in zinc.
Interesting. Yeah, I should refer people to Chris Masterjohn's series of wonderful podcasts on managing your nutritional status for all of these vitamins and minerals that we've been talking about. Have you been listening to those?
I have been, and been impressed. And I've definitely learned some things from him that I've passed on. Really good.
Yeah, he's absolutely on fire at the moment. Since leaving academia, he just cannot stop turning content out. Absolutely astonishing. And his masterclass on antioxidant defense system is also quite incredible. That I should link to those things in the show notes for this episode, so people can find them. They're absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it was really good. I loved his column on glutathione and have incorporated that if, you know, you have either an acute or a chronic pulmonary problem, you probably have a glutathione deficiency. Mm-hmm. Aha, what a nice little pearl to have that.
Mm-hmm. And do you measure for any markers of oxidative stress?
I do. Well, I really do in the Genova NutriVal panel. So they measure levels of CoQ10 and glutathione, and then they measure lipid peroxides and 8-hydroxy-DG in the urine. I'll do it that way. And then, so if I have a patient who I'm at all worried about cardiovascular health, and I kind of had this awakening recently to remind myself that everybody who's over the age of 50 should be concerned about cardiovascular health, because still the number one problem, no matter how healthy you think you are. So I do test the hsCRP in everybody. And if it's elevated more than once, anybody can have it elevated once, but if it goes back to under one, that's great. But if it stays higher than that, I'll get Cleveland Heart Labs inflammatory panel. Do you use Cleveland Heart Lab?
No, you are going to have to tell me more about this.
So they're an incredible lab for a couple reasons. And the way I really was introduced to them is they have a wonderful policy that enables people who have a high deductible insurance to have the kind of copay that Genova does. So as long as you have insurance, you have a really reasonable copay. But then in talking to them, what's really remarkable about them is the tests they have to offer. So if you have an elevated hsCRP, I can order their cardiac inflammatory panel, and it's really incredibly reasonably priced. People end up getting it for 10% of the face value of the test if they have any insurance at all. So it'll measure oxidized LDL and LPLA2 and myeloperoxidase. And then they've expanded it to include a couple other markers of cardiovascular stress, like ADMA or MDMA, and you can add a TMAO, which I don't really know what to make of that. But I will look for, and each of these markers of cardiovascular inflammation correlates to a different degree of endothelial dysfunction.
Okay.
And you would address them all a little bit the same way, although all a little bit different. You know, yes, you take out the inflammatory sources in somebody's lifestyle and increase the anti-inflammatories, but some of them are more specific. For instance, if you're working with people who are ApoE4, so at risk for heart disease or Alzheimer's disease, then maybe the oxidized LDL means something that it wouldn't mean in an ApoE3 person. Maybe it means they're having too much dairy or too much coke. We're really going far afield from autoimmune disease, aren't we?
Yeah, I know, but it's good though. I like to just follow the flow, you know. Oh, you're making me think about, I've just got back from Brian Walsh's training in Denver, which was just unbelievable. So maybe, do you know who Brian Walsh is? He's a naturopathic doctor from Maryland.
I know his name, but I don't know his work.
He is taking blood chemistry to the next level. He really is a quite astonishing critical thinker and biochemist. And I think most people listening to this podcast will be by now familiar with his Metabolic Fitness Pro training course, where he teaches the basic biochemistry. And I think you really need to have a good handle on that before you can properly interpret blood chemistry. But Brian's mission is to get as much information out of a basic blood chemistry as people are currently getting from all of the advanced fancy testing, that some of which you've just been talking about. So, for example, he spent most of a day talking about how you can use bilirubin and uric acid and GGT, which are three very inexpensive markers on most blood chemistries, as markers that can tell you what's going on with your antioxidant defense system. So absolutely incredible. Unfortunately, these resources are not available online at the moment, but you can go back to Denver and see Brian present this. And it's just unbelievable. It was 800 pages of stuff in 2 days. And he spent a ton of time on the whiteboard as well. So absolutely amazing. Highly recommend that.
It's great because, you know, sometimes you have to talk people. There's a benefit from very specific testing, but things like the GGT, that's very specific too, and might prevail upon somebody to really see if they have fatty liver or something like that. And it sounds like he can read all sorts of other stuff into it too.
Yeah, absolutely. So he presented, and this is all published in the literature, a fatty liver index that has a very complicated formula, but it seems to be 80% accurate in its ability to predict fatty liver. And then there was other formulas that he presented that would actually show the different stages of fatty liver. So you can have simple steatosis, and then you can have, you know, like the fibrosis moves in. There's actually three stages of fatty liver. And so he presented a formula to predict each of them. And this turns out to be more accurate than doing a biopsy, because you may see histological changes with the liver which are uneven. And so when you do a biopsy, you may get a good bit or you may get a bad bit. You don't really know. And so you really have to do an ultrasound to diagnose this thing. And it's amazing. He presented some data that showed the liver enzymes of a whole bunch of people. I think it was thousands of people had all been diagnosed with fatty liver via ultrasound. And their liver enzymes are all completely normal, right? It's just not a good way to diagnose fatty liver whatsoever. So you really have to. The formula that he presented, it took into account some other biomarkers that were not blood. So it was actually BMI. And I wonder whether that formula could be even better if it was the hip to waist ratio.
Right. Or waist to height. I like waist to height.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just super, there's no way that you could implement any of what he was teaching without some software to support this. So I'm quite excited to get cracking with one of my software engineering friends who's actually been on the podcast, actually, Fabian. And we're going to implement some blood chemistry software to see if we can bring to life some of what Brian was teaching this weekend.
That'll be great because, you know, some people really do just need a little bit of information about what you think's going on with them and they can run with it. And, you know, and other people, they want you to do the whole test because they can't really believe that they have to stop eating whatever you're telling them to stop eating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm one of those people that when you show me a test that tells me this is not working for me, I'm sure as hell going to do something about it. You know, it's a very powerful stick.
I had to be dragged kicking and screaming, you know, to give up. I'd been sort of playing around with the whole paleo thing, but really couldn't imagine that I could give up my bread. But I was set to go to Paleo FX. So this was the first time. This was about 5 years ago. And so I decided I had to stop bread for at least a month before I went to Paleo FX. And, you know, then, like, you don't even look back. It's like, what was I thinking?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I would agree. I mean, if you were in France and there was a baker around the corner that baked bread twice a day, I can understand why you would not want to give up bread. But in the US, I'm sorry, you just don't make any good bread. You really need to go to France to appreciate that.
Well, I like all that, you know, crunchy granola, whole wheat stuff. But, you know, if I can, I don't have a big explosive gastrointestinal reaction. I just know it's better for me not to eat it. So
right.
I can sneak in a few pieces a year and that's fine.
Right. I really wanted to ask you, I know I'm running a bit long on time here, but I really wanted to ask you about what potential stresses you might see in the gut and if you do any gut testing and whether the microbiome might be playing a role in autoimmunity.
You know, I do look at the gut and that, so I mostly use Genova Diagnostics, but I also use Doctor's Data stool testing, and I'll go with some of their markers for leaky gut. And I find that a part of their test really useful. You know, look at the level of inflammation in your gut, or look at the degree, you know, the eosinophilic protein or IgA something. And that's pretty consistent with what I usually expect to see in people. When it gets to the microbiome, I have there's like different parts. Like sometimes you really get a pathogen, and that's helpful because then you can figure out what you're going to do about the pathogen. By far the more common usefulness for me in the microbiome, and particularly with people over a certain age, is the incredible paucity of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium. Wow. And, you know, we should have a lot of that. And really almost everybody over 50 doesn't, they may have bifidobacterium on the looking at the species there, but once it cultures out, the bifido doesn't culture out. So it's not a really vital part of the stool. You know, the part of the microbiome report where it really talks about the actual diversity of species. I don't know what your experience has been. I talked about this a little bit with Michael Ruscio, and I'm just not really sure where this goes. So if I, you know, they on the Genova panel, they rate you, do you have not very much diversity in your right. microbiome, or do you have a lot of diversity? And the patients I have who have a lot of diversity have all been sick, you know, not very healthy patients. So one woman with MS, one woman with fibromyalgia, and the people who have lower than optimal diversity, I don't think we understand that yet.
No, absolutely not. I totally agree with you. And I get it. The analogy is, imagine a bar that's really, really crowded, and you were a pathogen on the outside, and you're trying to get into the bar to order a drink, and you wouldn't be able to because the bar is so crowded. But what happens right. if the bar is already crowded with a bunch of vipers, right? People that are not helping. So maybe that's what it is. It's a diverse and unfavorable microbiome.
Maybe, but, you know, I mean, if you think of moist, the whole hygiene kind of hypothesis and the fact that autoimmunity corresponds with greater affluence and a more hygienic environment. And so you'd think that diversity would be good. But yes, you're right. I guess it's we don't know enough about the nature of the diversity. You're diverse with a whole bunch of good players who keeping the bar well-stocked, clean, and with really good music. And Jane, on the other hand, over here has a bunch of drug dealers keeping the bar stocked. Right. That's two different kinds of diversity.
And have you had any good luck manipulating the gut microbiome? And if so, what type of treatments do you use?
I think I've had better luck dealing with small, well, not really. I don't really try and manipulate the whole, well, I guess I do, in that if somebody has a paucity of lactobacillus or bifidobacterium, I will just suggest they take a lot more of it. And I have a few different products depending on what that I rely on, depending on what the key problem is. So, you know, if their problem is more in the upper gut or in the lower gut, am I trying to move things along? Am I trying to improve their immune function? So I will push bifidobacterium in somebody who has a paucity of bifidobacterium and they get sick a lot. And do I think it works? I can't really keep the data well enough. But, you know,
yeah.
Everybody should be either eating fermented foods on a regular basis. I do believe that there is a link that's more complex that we can understand that I can just cut to the chase and say, if you're not eating fermented foods on a regular basis or farming or living with animals, you need to take some kind of probiotic on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And then we'll begin to pick and choose which one might be better. What do you do?
Yeah, something very similar, right? We do a kind of a weeding and then seeding, right? So if we do some gut testing and your gut is full of a whole bunch of vipers. So for example, I saw a test the other day where Giardia was present, right? So, I mean, that's a known pathogen, not controversial at all. You really need to get rid of that before you can start worrying about putting back some of the beneficial bacteria. And then we do use probiotics, but I'm starting to wonder whether the most effective strategy is perhaps using some prebiotic fibers, but then in particular eating a wide variety of non-starchy vegetables. And I would refer people to my recent interview with Lauren Peterson, where she had been doing a longitudinal study using many different types of gut microbiome sequencing and then also doing food logging. So she was able to see which were the foods that were leading to an increase in the beneficial bacteria. And I think that she agreed with me that maybe that was the best strategy, and that probiotics, although they do have their uses, may not be the solution long term.
Certainly in a general routine way, I agree with you that you need to have the prebiotic fiber in there. And so there's a whole nother rabbit hole, which I want you to go down with somebody on your podcast.
Okay.
These zero carb people who are just eating meat and eggs. And I've talked to them via Twitter, so it's not completely in great depth, about what happens to their bowel function and their general immunity, their general health, as they are completely avoiding what we think are so essential, these non-starchy vegetables. They're just eating meat and eggs, and they claim after a week or two, everything's great.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, and I should refer people, hopefully the video will be published by the time that this podcast interview is out, but I saw Jeff Gerber is a medical doctor from Denver, and he had his physician's assistant, and I apologize for not remembering her name, but she gave a really nice presentation on this exact thing, right? So they must be seeing this in their practice, the people that go on a very low carbohydrate diet, and that means no vegetables. And with what I know about the gut microbiome, which is not much, I think this is a pretty bad strategy. But the only thing I would add to her presentation that I thought was missing was that we know that there's animal fiber, right? So certain things inside of whole animals, like if you eat sardines, for example, you're eating the whole animal, then some of the collagen may be fermentable. And I'll link to Bill Lagakos from Calories Proper has written about this. So I'll link to his article, which I thought was very interesting. But I'm still going to eat my vegetables, right? I don't think that's an optimal strategy.
Yeah, we're having a little debate at the house where I'm saying, hey, do you want to try the zero carb for a few weeks? No.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. I have one more question for you, which is, and I honestly don't know the answer. This is going to sound like a greasy used car salesman pitch, but is your practice still open at the moment?
At the moment, it's not. I open it about every 6 months for about a month. And then during that month, the next 6 months tends to fill up. So at the moment, it's open only to memory care patients. So patients who are interested in doing Dr. Bredesen's protocol, I'll let them in at any point. But for general purposes, it'll probably be open again in June or July.
Excellent. Yeah. And I know that you did a presentation for Physicians for Ancestral Health on the Bredesen protocol. And I haven't actually seen that talk yet. I couldn't see it on the Physicians for Ancestral Health channel. Presumably it's unlisted, but
it will be up. It hasn't been posted yet. And I did it, a little bit on the general protocol, but really specifically on the kind of little nootropics, the things like Bacopa monniera and ashwagandha and things that we as medical doctors don't really know anything about.
Okay. Well, I will find that video and I'll link to it in the show notes so people can learn more about the Bredesen protocol. Is there anything else that you'd want people to know about?
Yeah, a million things, but I think we can stop there.
Okay. Well, in that case, best I have you back on in a few months' time and we can talk about something completely different.
That'd be great. So nice to chat with you, Chris. I hope to meet you in person sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. We will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.